Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are slapping all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my vision!
I'd hit that.
Follow I'd Hit That on Instagram and X. That username is at IHTPod. IHTPOD. Merchandise is now available. Go to IdHitThatPodcast.com. Spell it all out, IdHitThatPodcast.com. Get a t-shirt, hoodie, coffee mug, more stuff to come. Buying merch, great way to support the show. IdHitThatPodcast.com. I'm in Nashville with Chris McHugh.
Yeah.
Part two.
Right? After all these years.
Now, we were just talking about that when you pulled up. And I was saying, like, okay, so I didn't look it up myself. So let's guess it was 8 or 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. The show started 11 years ago. Actually, now that I think about it, it could have been 10, 11 years ago. It's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible it was a decade ago.
I'm going to say 2013.
That makes sense. A decade ago.
Yeah.
And we were just starting to say, because you remembered it was at a hotel in Los Angeles.
Yeah, the Sofitel, right across from Beverly Center.
I did not remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that your spot in L.A.?
Well, you know, through the years, it was just seemed to be the place that the tours that I was on would stay in L.A., you know?
That's what it was. You were with
Keith. I was with Keith, Herber. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and Iveson was there.
Now, that was the other thing, because you guys were in touch.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember... I don't know if I knew. Like, I don't know if he just showed up, kind of.
He did just show up.
For me, in other words.
Yeah, yeah.
And as far as I was concerned.
Yes. Yeah. But we had met each other because of Craviato, and I had seen him play with... I think I had seen him play already with...
Gautier.
Gautier.
Yeah.
The go-to word when you don't know anything, you say dude. With dude. He was playing with dude.
The dude.
But, yeah, and I still keep in touch with Michael. Yeah, yeah.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's doing good.
I like to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we have to maybe shoot him a text at some point. We'll send him a picture. That's what we'll do. That would have been great if we had worked that out. Now, that would have been epic. So, a lot has happened. Well, 10 years, man. Mm-hmm. I guess a lot is gonna happen.
Oh, yeah. Tons happened. I stopped working with Keith as far, you know, live stuff. The last gig I did was January 1st of 2015. And that's actually, like, the last live, like, big gig I've done.
Wow.
I mean, I played in clubs and different things like that, and a couple of TV things, but no touring.
Done.
I don't know. You never say never, but...
Because that wasn't even your plan. You didn't say, I'm done for good. You just said, I got to stop right now.
I think at that point I was done. So like, just to give the listeners a little background, I mean, I had played on... three of Keith's records before I ever went on the road with him. And when I went on the road with him, I was 40. I toured with him from 40 to 50.
Wow.
And it was a really intense 10 years. And, you know, I did all of his recording, and I was his musical director, band leader. I mean... So I was cooked. He knew I wasn't into it anymore. You just tell, you know. Just
let's, like this so thing. Now that there's that distance, let's go back for like.
Okay.
Give me some. Like, You have memories of like him looking at you and like being like, "What, dude?" Like,
well, it was more of me looking at him, going, "What the fuck are you doing?" I think we just were headed in different directions musically, and you know, I mean, look, man, all due respect, dude is incredibly talented, and I love him. But I think when you work with anybody that long, you know, you're just done, you know.
I mean, yeah, it runs its course, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, I mean, if he called me to play on something or whatever, you know, I'd love that. But as far as kind of like, you know, where you're just, we're working with each other, it feels like around the clock, you know.
Yeah.
And, and I think he needed a change too, you know. Like, I mean, it had done its thing. Because he, the way that like a, you know, I don't know what pop people are doing, but like a country act like Keith is, because he really is a country act, you know, even though his show is not per se country. Like, he doesn't have fiddles and steel and stuff like that. But the touring schedule and the album schedule is on the country kind of thing. I mean, it's a new album,
right?
You know, the longest you can have between albums is 18 months basically. So it's album tour, album tour, album tour. And
just never,
even on the slow years, we were doing, you know, 50, 60 dates, you know. And so it just kind of runs its course. I love him. I think he's incredible. I learned a ton from him. And, you know, the biggest thing when I started working with him is that he was an opening act, and his goal with this band that he put together was that it would take him into a headlining status. And so we started the tour playing large theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of it, he was playing arenas. So, yeah. And that was in the first, by the time we got through the first 60 shows of that year, the next tour we did arenas. So, you know, it did the thing, and it's great. I wouldn't change a thing about the time that I worked with him. And I mean, it's, you know, it's a big part of my life.
Yeah.
And I got to make a lot of statements in it. He allowed me to really be myself, and you know, you can't, I mean, that's so rare, you know, to even get that opportunity. A lot of tours, people you tour with, you know, that you don't play on the record, and
yeah,
you know, so I mean, yeah. That's a rare thing too, to be the guy who plays on the records and the guy who goes out on the road. And so it was all great.
And again, you were MD.
I was MD, yeah. So I mean, any TV show stuff or anything like that, or if we did something where, you know, we were adding horns or a different arrangement or that kind of thing, of, you know, adding different musicians, you know, putting a new arrangement together. Sometimes, you know, we did things with background singers and horns, and, you know, so you get pretty heavily involved in all that, all the way down to dealing with just the union aspect of it. And, mm-hmm. You know, worked a few times. We brought in Chuck Lavelle, came in and played. We did a Stones tribute on Jimmy Fallon. We did Tumbling Dice on there, had horns too. And so anything that had to do with that. And then also, you know, stuff even where the band is miming, and, you know, for those who don't know, a lot of TV shows that you do, the band is not really playing live, but Keith's elements were. But, you know, we would cut live versions of those, so it was at least that band, and it was a little looser than the record. So I was responsible for doing all of that kind of stuff, and dealing with tracks, and, you know, I mean, it's...
That gets old, huh?
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, they hired three people to replace me, basically.
That's what I was going to say. It's wearing all the hats, right?
Yeah.
That's really what it is.
Yeah. Well, and I'll say, too, I mean, full disclosure, you know, I took too much on as well. You know, at a certain point...
Yeah.
I think he would have been okay if I had said, hey, man, let's bring... Because I was operating Ableton also, doing all of the editing and everything. Like, a lot of acts now, you know, you'll have an MD and you have a operator.
Mm.
And so I was playing drums, MD, you know, running all of the tracks, editing the tracks. Like, you know, if we did sound check and say, hey, let's shorten this section or lengthen another section.
Well, what would have given... Okay, so in retrospect or looking at it now, what would have given more longevity, would you say? Which...
I think at a certain point, if I just had been playing drums.
Been just the drummer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hell yeah.
But wouldn't that mean that you don't get to weigh in as much on other things?
I think that would have been... I think it was time to let go of that, you know?
So you think that would add more to longevity? To just...
I think it would have.
Did you clock in and clock out? Is that part of it?
No. I think a big part of it is that I was not good at setting boundaries.
Oh, the bigger shit, yeah.
Like I
got you.
Took on too much that I didn't need to. I should have farmed more stuff out.
Right. And you didn't want to let him down.
Down. I mean, and man,
wanted to show you were capable.
Yeah. And when I met him, I mean, you know, he was, I mean, he had been in the band The Ranch, and you know, he was doing his first solo record. And, I mean, he didn't really have any money or anything. So, you know, I had a very strong loyalty to him. And I still do.
I
still do, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't one of those bad blood things at all.
No.
He's, I mean, I've seen that guy. He is the truest sense of an entertainer. I mean, I would tell him all the time. I was like, "Man, you don't need us. You can do this thing." He's born for it, man.
Yeah.
He is a born entertainer, and not only that, he's a born communicator as a singer. Like, you can have amazing technical singers, but people who can't tell a story.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, the you, and rarely do you ever get both at the same time.
Right.
You know. I mean, they're out there, but the guys like, you know, pick your greatest front man. Those guys are communicators, from Steven Tyler to Michael Hutchins to, I mean, you know, Bowie to
David Lee Roth, damn it.
Roth, totally.
Frontman. Freddie Mercury, just frontman.
Oh yeah.
Front
communicating
man.
The party. And in those, you have some amazing singers, and not so much.
And by the way, it's funny because I wasn't necessarily a huge fan, but I was watching some of that Taylor Hawkins stuff where he's doing, by the way, Freddie, speak like doing frontman thing, and it's like, dude had it.
Oh yeah,
it's really funny.
Oh yeah,
he like kind of has that X Factor frontman thing.
Yes. Yeah.
Which you're talking about.
Yes.
Which is rare.
It's so rare.
You're right.
You have to be born to do that kind of thing, and
it's not taught.
And Keith is a like the most solid example of that. And the thing is he'll always have longevity because he can do that.
Right.
There's no gag. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? There's no... The act is he can fucking entertain people.
Right.
You know what I mean? What's
right.
the act, right? There always has to be an act.
I'm a song and dance man.
Right. And at the end of the day, man, you give that guy the most basic musical instrument and he'll hold an audience.
You wow. know?
And, I mean, if anything, I mean, there's a lot of things that are really impressive about him, but for me, I mean, I've seen him turn crowds that were dead and lifeless, and he takes a lot of pride in it, man. His live show, and for people to walk out of there, he's very conscious of, even down to like people getting like fucking babysitters and shit, and
right.
what it costs to get them in that seat. So,
right.
You know, I've I don't think I ever saw him phone in anything. He is a born entertainer. But enough about dude, man. He's but yeah, so it just was, you know, that that change. I had a health scare. I had a heart attack in, what year was that? 2014. And
what does that feel like?
Well, that one in particular was the scariest because it was not a traditional. I've had two heart attacks. P.S.
You had one before that or after?
After that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So this is the first one.
The first one.
Okay.
We were in Vegas and we were playing an award show there, and we did a concert the night before the TV show. So this was like a Saturday night. We played outside and I noticed I had like what seemed like heartburn, you know, like you eat spicy food.
Oh, I know, heartburn.
And you get heartburn.
Do you get that? But that's what I was curious. Did you get that at the time?
No.
Okay.
Well, maybe I did a little acid reflux.
So did you think that? Were you?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. I thought, man, okay. I ate something bad. And then it did not go away. And I finally went to sleep that night. Woke up. I got my story backwards. We did the taping, and then we did a show that night, a live show. And I was flying out the next morning. So right after the show is when I get the heartburn thing. I go back to the hotel. It's still there. And but I'm like, oh, fuck it. It's no big deal. I think I took a couple of Advil or something like that. Finally went to sleep. Got up early, got on the plane, flew all the way to Nashville, and about 10 minutes before we landed, I felt nauseous like I'd never felt nauseous before. I think I even had, like, just to be brutally honest, I think I had, like, diarrhea, like,
yeah,
at the airport.
Yeah.
Did that, got a car to my house, and then when I got to my house, it just kept getting worse to the point of where my whole body was aching. But I did not feel it, like, in my left arm, and I didn't feel it specifically in my chest. It was all kind of in that heartburn thing in my throat. And so after him and hawing for a minute, my daughter, who was home at the time, said, I can't help you. She's just like a teenager at the time. She's like, Dad, I think she gave me some Tums and I threw those up immediately. And she said, Dad, this is freaking me out. You need to call 911. And I did. And I got there within minutes. When I was on the phone with them and I was telling them what my symptoms were, they were like, well, you could be having a heart attack right now. So I had a certain amount of aspirin I had to take. And they came to the house and I think I walked down to the paramedic, got in there and they start taking vitals immediately, you know, put in an IV and gave me nitroglycerin, which is supposed to prevent a heart attack, you know, temporarily. And I still was kind of aching all over. Well, when I got to the hospital, it was about, I think, maybe 4 o'clock in the evening, and got into a room pretty quickly. And they took my vitals again, and they took my blood, and they were like, well, we don't know what's wrong with you. They gave me like a little Demerol, which I started to feel better then because, you know, it's Demerol.
Yeah.
And then, man, they did a bunch of tests. Like, they did an ultrasound and all kinds of shit. And it got to be around 11 o'clock at night. And the on staff, the head doctor said, well, you have a couple options. You can go home and then come back tomorrow for more tests. And then the woman that saved my life, which is the on-call cardiologist, a woman named Dr. Gina Chandler, said, if you were my brother, I would tell you to stay. She said, your vitals and all of this, they're not telling us anything, but I believe that you are on the edge of a cardiac arrest, and I want to take your blood about every hour. You're not going to get any sleep, but only your enzyme levels are going to tell us what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And around, so they got me in a room,
mm-hmm.
around 6:30 the next morning, I wake up to her saying, hey, you're in the middle of an arrest right now. Your enzyme levels are through the roof. We're taking you to the cath lab, which is where they do any kind of stent stuff, and they can actually see what's going on. But at that moment, before they take you to the cath lab, you sign away all rights for them to keep you alive. Because if you go into the cath lab and you're totally blocked, because that's when they can see mm-hmm. what's going on with your arteries,
mm-hmm.
then they have to take you into open heart surgery immediately.
And shit can go wrong.
So she was like, we're prepping what do they call that? It's like a musical term. Anyway, operating room there for open heart, but we'll take you to the cath lab first. When we got in there, you know, they run a catheter, you know, just kind of down in your crotch and all the way up through your heart. They shoot in, you know, the dye, and the dye shows where all the blockage is, and she immediately found it. But it was a Widowmaker, which is a valve behind the artery that's kind of tucked in. And the reason why they call it the Widowmaker is that its symptoms are not traditional. So it's the title Widowmaker is because it is the one where you come home from work complaining that you don't feel well,
mm-hmm.
you take a couple Tums, you go to sleep, and then your wife or, you know, wakes up and you're dead.
Yeah.
So within like 45 minutes, I had a stent put in and I was in a recovery room. So, you know, it was scary and but they were like, you know, hey, you get just a week of light activity, but you need to, at that point, just go back right into regular life, you know. And, you know, you have some physical therapy. You go and they hook up an EKG while you walk on a treadmill. You do that 3 times a week, you know, for the first month or so. And everything was fine. They were like, fine, yeah, you can go back to playing drums and do whatever. So I had about maybe, we were in a dead spot in terms of touring. And I didn't miss any dates or anything. And,
that's crazy.
Yeah. And,
They knew what was going on.
Oh, yeah. No. They, Keith, management, and everybody. Yeah. They all.
And they're like, you okay? You got this, buddy?
People have them all the time, you know? And
I guess so.
You know, I mean, I was 49 at the time.
But in retrospect.
I mean, it's better to keep moving.
Okay.
The other problem, though.
Go ahead.
Is, you know, I'm a recovered alcoholic addict, and
mm-hmm.
I, mm-hmm. after that first heart attack, I kept in my curricular activities and I kept using drugs, and consequently, 3 years later, I had a second.
Okay. Well, okay.
So, and that was the final straw of like, man, I can't fucking live this way anymore. And
but you basically continued, you're saying, a certain lifestyle after that first one.
Yes.
You just,
fuck yeah.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, the classic.
Yeah.
Classic.
Well, you were cleaned out. Shit. You had your pipes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was great.
Starting fresh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the funny thing, man. I mean, is that's how sick you can be, you know. crazy. But, so.
What are we talking, by the way? And you say, like, can we, what are we talking about?
Oh, what I was, what, yeah. like my DOC and all that kind of stuff?
Like,
oh man, any kind of stimulant.
Any kind.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you got?
Oh man, Adderall, Blow, Vyvanse, you know. And the thing, even like Hydros, you know, which is a pain pill, that has a certain euphoria to it too. It has a, there's a stimulant factor to it as well. So there were those and kind of fucking anything, man. No.
Mixing, mashing, just...
Oh, yeah.
Whatever.
Whatever.
Whatever. Yeah.
And...
Busy, keeps you going.
Yeah.
On the road.
Yeah, and I never lost a gig or any kind of shit like that. I was pretty under the radar user. Drinking, on the other hand, I mean, I could get pretty fucked up in public, you know. Pretty sloppy. But that was an issue as well, too. And, yeah, it just... so between the first and second heart attacks, too, went through breakup and, you know, beginning of a divorce. And so, man, I was fucking spiraling. The lowest point I'd ever been in my life. You know, I mean, called a rock bottom, for sure. And it just was like... everything's got to change, you know, after that second one. And it was a real, I mean, you know, for the, anybody's struggling, it is difficult to surrender, but for me, it's completely, it's given me a life, you know, saved my life to admit defeat over those things, over drugs and alcohol. And, I did it the traditional sense. I mean, I went to rehab and then it's all, you know, 12 step stuff that I do. You know, man, just as a PSA, you know, if anybody's struggling out there, just ask for help. But, so during that time, I mean, you know, I'm off the road with Keith and, but I finished the entire year. Like I did another 60 dates that year after the heart attack. and a bunch of fucking records too.
After the second heart attack?
No, after the first. Yeah.
Okay.
After the first, yeah. And,
well, I figure, I mean, obviously the dates, I figured that.
Yeah,
well.
And like, so the last show I did with him was January 1st, 2015. And immediately went on a nice long vacation. My wife at the time, we went to Hawaii for a couple of weeks. And I was exhausted, you know. And then just got back into doing albums, you know, record dates. Did that, you know, 15, 16, 17. And at the end of 17 is when, November of 17, is when the second one happened. Actually, it was Halloween. Now, that one was extremely traditional heart attack. Felt like somebody had grabbed my collarbones and was like pulling them down. And the elephant on the chest, that whole.
What were you doing when this happened?
I had had an appointment. It might have even been a doctor's appointment. And it was actually with my psychiatrist. And
nice. Nice, actually. Interesting.
Yeah.
But you weren't alone. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. And went home to take a nap, and that's when it hit.
Oh. I thought you meant it started to hit during the...
No.
Oh.
No, that was like...
Oh, it did hit you alone.
Yeah, I was alone. Yeah. That one I was alone, and immediately, like within 90 seconds, I called 911.
Because you're like, this.
I know what this is. Yeah. And it really fucking bummed me out. Because it just was like, come on, man. Not again, you know. But I knew it. Like, you know, just the way it felt in my body. And, yeah, like, again, within 45 minutes of calling 911, I was in, you know, post-op recovering.
Oh, fuck.
But that, it was really dark. That was really dark after that. That was just like, I cannot live this way anymore. And it's best described as there's a moment before you recognize that you need help. And I would, it's one of the best descriptions I've ever heard. It's just like a cold wind of abandonment. And you're kind of, you're at the edge looking at your life going, I cannot fucking do this. I'm dying. And I literally was dying. And the first time I was, but I couldn't even admit, like, you know what I mean? That's how sick I was. And it's, look, man, I mean, you know, being an addict and an alcoholic, I mean, it's a disease, you know? I believe that. And in my experience, it is. It's treatable, though. That's the thing. And it's the only disease that tells you that you don't have it. It tells you that you don't have it to the point of where you can have a fucking heart attack. You keep doing the thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was kind of at that moment I realized that, all right, I just, I have to admit, you know, what I am and what I'm doing, and that all my tricks were done. Like, I couldn't, I had no way out of it, you know? And that's the funny thing. And you know, the cool thing about it all is, absolutely has made my life so much better. Every aspect of my life, you know, even my playing. And the way that I interact with people and all of it. So, again, you know, I hate to keep saying this, but man, reach out. If anybody's struggling with any of that stuff, it's easy to, you can just look online and get to a meeting. Seriously, because it will kill you, you know.
How long, obviously it was a dark time, I get that. Like, how long are we talking? It took years to kind of come back?
From the second one?
As far as just like that, on that.
Oh, yeah, mentally, oh yes, early, yeah, yeah, oh man.
Took years.
Longer than I knew. Okay, so first of all, I knew I had a lot of work to do. And that means that everything about my life needed to change. What was the priorities? All of that stuff needed to shift. And I had to get into, you know, because really, I mean, to be brutally honest, it's a spiritual disease, you know, and I had no, I had kind of lost like a greater purpose. Things are bigger than we are anyway. And I don't care what you're into, like, whether you're whatever religion you're into or a philosophy or anything. Most people that are into those things have a realization that there is something bigger than you. If not at the very least, it's humanity itself, right? It's your place in and amongst, you know, men and women and people of all, whatever you are, you know. I'm not saying that that's all there is or whatever. But, and I had kind of lost that sense of for me, being a man among men, you know,
mm-hmm.
And just really, you know, you're up in your ego quite a bit, and every relationship I had suffered because of it in one way or another. Now, you can meet people and they'll go, well, what the fuck is he talking about? Like, I remember then, he was fine, you know?
You're cool.
Yeah. I mean, I was honestly probably high when we did that.
Yeah. Yeah, you probably were. You probably were.
But, you know, but you weren't special. That was just every day of the week at that point. And stimulants are tricky too, because they're not downers, you know. And no. You can, man, doing an interview, I mean, oh, great, we're going to talk about me. This will be great. You know?
Right.
Love that.
Well, you were also, like you said, maybe mixing and matching. Who knows?
Oh, yeah.
Like, who knows?
I don't know what it
was. And by the way, can I ask you?
Yes, please.
What, I mean, does Keith know at the time? Is he aware?
No, I was way...
it's on the DL. It's
oh, all fuck just, yeah. Totally.
But that's what it's all about, secrets and hiding.
It it's
secrets, your cover-ups.
Your secrets kill you. Yeah,
that's what I mean. It's all about just the
absolutely
the covering your tracks. The
well, let's just talk about man. All right, so one of the things that the greatest freedoms now is not having to fucking score dope.
Right.
I don't think people understand. Like, you can have all the money in the world, but if all of your contacts are dry, doesn't fucking mean anything.
Right.
Yeah. And there is nothing worse than that. There's nothing worse than that, you know. But that isn't that just the brutal reality of how horrible the thing is. Like, there's never enough. There's never enough. And I would say that that was a big theme for me even before sobriety. There is never enough. Never enough work, never enough money. Like, it's just like, yeah, fine, yeah, I want more, you know. And after I got sober, I made my world really small. I was still working. I mean, I still played on stuff.
But, does that mean, like, starting with the physical, though? Like, do you downsize? Are you...
Just, like, you know, working the steps. The design of working the steps is to get you to a place of being right-sized. To get you to a place where you're a person among persons, you know. And,
humility.
Humility. It's all about humility. And not humiliation, because you're already dealing with that. You're already dealing with that on a personal level.
Oh, you're humbled because you've been brought to your knees, and exactly. Now you're just like, all right, help me, I'm done. Like you said, I'm out of tricks.
Yes, I'm out of tricks. Every relationship I have is fucked.
Right.
You look around and go, this is a fucking shit show, and the only common denominator is me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in active addiction, it's... Everything is everybody else's fault, you know? And the big moment of clarity is when you realize it's like, nope, it's you, man. And again, I didn't have, you know, I had two fucking heart attacks. But I didn't have, like, DUIs, I didn't get busted, you know, with right. dope or any kind of shit like that. But I mean, man, you get secretive enough, you know.
You gotta hide it at work. That's what we're talking about here.
Dude, you just fucking put bills in your pockets. Let me deal.
No, but you know, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Like, you're on the job. You're on tour. Yeah. And that's why I was asking you, is it an open secret? You're like, oh, no. And nobody knew because you're just hiding it.
God, yeah. And again, you know, stimulants are different because you just seem like you're really you're really into it, man.
Looking good today, man.
Yeah.
Like,
wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
So again, that's why it's different than you know, pain pills or downers or even booze, you know. And the thing is like any kind of stimulant, I mean, you can drink like right. crazy and
right.
still maintain some composure, you know.
Right.
But beginning.
But you simplified.
Oh, yeah. Just like.
And you said with work?
Yeah, with everything. Mainly my perspective on what work is.
Oh.
And the size of it, right? So, like, whereas I would say it was really the most important thing to me, you know, was my career. And after getting sober, when I use this term of, like, making it right size, well, it's like a job is important and a career is important. And I think at this point we can all agree I was probably born to do this, right? So, you know, it isn't like, fuck this, I'm not doing it anymore. It's just, okay, this needs to become way lesser of a deal. And which means if somebody calls me to play on something, I say yes, but I'm not going to hang my emotional barometer on what the work is or what it pays or who it's for. You know, that all of that shit needed to go away and it needed to get kind of back to basics. It was really a lot like, 17, 18, 19, and even part of 20, my headspace was in this pretty similar to where I was when I first started doing records. Like, it was whatever job I'm working on, that's the most important thing I'm doing at that moment, and I don't care what it is. I don't care what it turns out to be. I'm just lucky enough to be getting to do it. Whereas my attitude before I got sober was, they're fucking lucky to have me. That's a good way to put it. You know what I mean? Such a dick. Like, you know, and it's funny. It's taken me, so now on November 1st, I'll have 6 years of sobriety. And just in the last year or so, I've kind of felt like, okay, everything that was good about that guy is back. But my ego is in check. And if it gets out of check, you know, there are people that I'm accountable for that too, you know. That's the difference in it. And you know, it's a fine line, right? Because to do this job, you have to have a certain level of confidence. Nobody wants like a teddy bear that comes in that's like, you know, full of self-doubt or any kind of shit like that. It's a chest out job, you know. And it took a minute to get comfortable with that guy, you know. The design of sobriety in a 12-step program is for you to get comfortable in your own skin, all which ways you are. You have to be, you know, we referred to the steps, you know, the ones where you get into doing an inventory are about you looking at your shadows, and you got to get good with it, because there's no way, nobody's perfect, and you learn what makes you tick, or what can own your ass about yourself, whether it's fear or envy, you know. People struggle with lust and all kinds of, it's based on the seven deadly sins, if you will. That's just a traditional way to look at it. It's much more subtle than
sloth,
that.
Gluttony,
all of that,
all of it,
all of
greed.
It. Yes, greed. Fuck. Greed.
Yeah, well, right. Back to money. That's money. Money.
Dude,
money.
Jobs. Never enough. All of it. And what does it affect? You know, well, it affects my pride because I should have these things, and you know, all of that kind of shit. And that's what you learn. You know, and you make that like, okay, I recognize that in myself. Now, if I channel that in the right way, then it's okay. Yeah, you got to make a living, you know. So greed is not great, but being responsible for the bills that you have, and then also if you want a certain lifestyle. So it's like, oh shit, you can actually make that a certain size. It doesn't have to fucking own your ass.
Right.
You know. Because all of those things, inevitably, there would be some situation to where I took what I call a punch to the gut. Because I didn't get what I wanted. And again, there's never enough, so I'm not going to get what I want anyway. So something happens, you know, an example of that would be I didn't get a certain gig I was gunning for, you know. Or I played on somebody's record previously, and they're going in again to record, and they're not using me, you know. All of that shit used to drive me fucking crazy. And if you look at my credits, you could look at, what the fuck? This dude is insane. Yes, I was insane. So those punches to the gut, you know, those were good reasons to use, you know, and to drink over.
Right.
Because I didn't have any emotional control or anything, you know.
Right. But hey, man, it's rock and roll.
Oh, so. It is. It is rock and roll, and some of that shit makes you the player that you are. But I'll say this, you know, being on this side of it, I certainly wish I had gotten sober earlier, because what I know now. Now, again, I'm not changing the past and all of that. I'm not talking about that. But even just management of shit that I think and feel is like, oh, you know, God, I'm not paying attention to that thought at all now.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know where it comes from. Oh, dude, that's just your ego. That's your pride.
Right.
Well, you just want what they have. That's what that's, you know, hitting you, you know? And that shit is just so stupid, because not only is it terrible to just be envious of others, but the even more cutting example of envy is what you have isn't good enough. And that's such a slap in the face, because if you can't value where you're at, there's no way to live in gratitude. You're always, everything fucking sucks. I hate all the shit that I have. And, you know, it's funny, man. I mean, and again, I'm not knocking ambition. I'm not knocking, drive or any of that kind of stuff. But when that shit owns you to the point of where you can't accept the way that your life is and the people that are around you, you know, then you're losing. You lose, you know. You're missing out. You're missing out on a lot of joy. And, you know, I'd say if anything, I mean, I really enjoy life now. And that's not to say I don't have rough days and shit still gets me down, but it only lasts like 10 minutes or so, you know. I start to go, well, there's other reasons for this, you know. And at the end of the day, when you don't get hired on something or you do get hired on something, trust me, you don't want to fucking know why somebody hired you. Because there's a million different reasons. And they can go, well, don't they hire you because you're just Chris McHugh? And like, no, not always. Sometimes they wanted somebody else and they weren't available, you know. You might have been the fifth call. That's what I'm saying. You don't want to know. You know what I mean? Don't investigate that shit. Like, you have to do the job, right? You have to be good at doing the job. But after that, you got to let that other shit alone. Like, you know, I'm not in charge of the results anymore. I'm just willing to do whatever I got to do. And I've tried to, you know, I mean, I do. I know that I have ability and quality that can make a record a better record. But that doesn't mean it's going to blow up, you know. That doesn't mean it's going to be heard everywhere and all of that, you know. It doesn't even mean I might not get replaced. And that's the cold, hard truth of the thing, you know. You can go in and think that you killed on something, and then you find out later, oh, no, dude, that's so-and-so. They replaced you. That stuff used to floor me, but I don't care about that part anymore. It's disappointing. But, and again, you know, I'm kind of talking in, I would say that the gist of what I'm trying to say is that there are disappointments in life, and how you react to those is really the bigger part of sobriety. And then on the other hand is when things are great. It's also how you react to that. Like, you going to self-sabotage this, you know, or are you going to make it more than what it really is, you know? It's like, it's emotional sobriety now at this point, because pretty early on, man, the desire to have to use or drink, that went away real quick. Then it's like, okay, well, how the fuck do I live life without my best friend? It was the regulator, you know, and it was also the shield.
It's so many. Isn't it a reward too? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day,
I thought it was.
That's what I'm saying. Oh, isn't it that? Can't wait to go home and just.
Yeah. Drink a half bottle of tequila by myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you've earned it.
What a reward.
Because you've earned it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I know.
For being a champ.
I know.
Like,
I know.
Come on, champ. It's your time.
Yeah, right. Well, like, I mean, and that's the thing is, you know, the way that I live more so now is that it's really not about me at all. Like, I understand, I have a better understanding, I should say, of like who I am and what I do. But I'm more focused on the things that are going on around me now than I ever was, you know. And consequently, it's made me a better listener in terms of being a musician. Because it's so easy to play on sessions and really just concentrate on what your part is. Now, I would listen to what other guys were playing, and I would certainly make notes of like, oh man, I need to jump on this lick that these guys are playing and all that kind of stuff. That's one thing. And that's kind of clinical in a way, you know, because you're just making marks on a chart. What I'm talking about is really listening to the particular pocket that's going on any given day, you know, and to play into that and to try to make something of that. And I react differently now than I used to, you know. I was a bit more of a bulldozer, you know. These are subtleties, too. I think only people that, like, really sort of study my playing would hear this subtle little difference. But the whole thing is a lot more fun now. Just doing sessions, making music. All of that gave me a greater appreciation for what I had all along. Mm. I'm able even to look back at older records I enjoy them more now. Whereas typically I'd kind of listen to them and just fucking pick them apart. That shit, blah, blah, blah. You gonna play that fucking fill again? You know?
Right.
You know, and that kind of shit. Anything that could sort of beat yourself up, you know? But, yeah, I mean, that's the gist of the, you know, sobriety. I mean, and relationship with my kids is so much better now. And they've seen, you know, a huge change in me too. And I'd say all my friends have seen it too. Guys have been, I mean, I was working today, over at Kid Rock's studio. I was in there with him. And the bass player, Craig Young, and the guitar player, Tom Bugavac, those guys I've been playing with for 30 years, you know.
Damn.
Craig. Tom, probably 25, you know. And they've totally seen, you know, big change. And, I mean, I would say, you know, I'm just kind of, you know, less obviously, you know, just not even being on a stimulant, you're less tight.
Yeah.
In terms of just your over rigidity, you know. There was
No, you're a different guy.
Yeah.
That I met. There's no question. I was a different guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, saved my life. Yeah, that's a most concise thing I can say, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I get that, and I think everyone gets it, that you had to go on that journey and just, you had to, like you said, get humble.
Yeah.
And you know, admit, as you said, ask for help.
Yeah.
Surrender, all that, mm-hmm. all that good stuff.
Yeah.
All the fun part, and then, but then, as you pointed out, though, so eloquently, it's a chest out job.
It is.
And so,
yeah.
You can remember back, I guess there was that time, I guess, where you just couldn't fake that, perhaps? And did you feel like...
Well, I mean, you know, at a certain point, if you believe the lore that surrounds you...
Yeah.
Then that starts to feed on itself. It's like, well, fuck, I don't know if I can be that person without this thing, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
The focus, supposedly, what it gives you... And, you know, you're just, I mean, you kind of, you know, you're sort of digging yourself and you dig life and everything sounds sparkly and
yeah.
all that kind of crazy shit. And, you know, the funny thing is that when you initially drink a cup of coffee, the same reaction that your brain has for like the first 20 minutes after having a cup of coffee, it looks exactly like it does on a stimulant. But of course, you know, your body can process caffeine, and the point is like, it's not really, it's just a sustained version of that, you know, being really kind of jacked on caffeine. But, you know, you just couldn't look inward. And, you know, you're using tomorrow's energy today when you're doing that as well. And so there was always kind of a certain point of when I crashed. And hopefully, you know, I I think I did okay with that never being kind of on a date or something like that, you know, on a record date. And, you know, you say shit that is not the kind of shit that people want to hear, like in terms of, you know, a working environment. And, you know, I don't know how easy I was to work with. Certainly at the end, I had a couple friends tell me that, man, the last couple of years were really bad, you know. And what that would look like would just be, you know, somebody that I probably wasn't taking a lot of direction, you know, and people would sing me ideas and shit like that, you know, probably said a lot of stupid shit back. And, you know, just not a great attitude, that kind of thing. And people could feel that, you know what I mean? Like, you could hide using as much as possible, but people can kind of tell that you're kind of, there's something off, you know? And so to like fast forward to what it's sort of taken to understand that, oh, okay, the role of you know, playing drums on a record or playing drums in a band, you know, there's a certain level of command that you need to have, because you don't ever want these guys to think or experience that you're going to drop the ball groove-wise on anything. They need to know that the one and the three and your backbeats, they're going to sit in the same spot. And if you come in and you are a mess emotionally, you can't really deliver that, you know. And so it really just was the kind of thing of like getting to a good place with, you know, enjoying playing again, enjoying making records again, and having results, you know, in sobriety. Because you're kind of crazy, man, for the first couple of years, you know. It just was, I learned by doing. And so that's really, right, you know, these years that I'm talking about, yeah. 18, 19, 20, you know, it's like, I wasn't playing like awful or any kind of shit like that. I wasn't as comfortable as I am now, you know? And so, it just took a minute. And, but there was all kind of growth on the way, you know? And things happening personally, and, you know, and things I was actually present for, as opposed to being under the influence of something. And, you know, that's a big deal. There is, you know, there's a dependability factor with my family that exists now that did not at the time, you know. I was pretty kind of, you know, I was very much sort of caught up in myself.
Yeah.
And I'm being very frank, you know, this is, I trust the listeners, if you will, but like, you know, I wasn't very approachable even as a father to a certain extent. I mean, I think I had a wall up, and in sobriety, all of that shit went away, you know? Because you start to see where your ego gets in the way of true relationship, you know? And working on that, and again, that's a daily thing, right? The way my ego is it's designed to, it wants to, it doesn't like, you know, humility. It doesn't like you. Or if it was humble, it was like the fake shit. You know, it's fake humility. And now it's, I would say, if anything, if you're like, oh, the change is probably, I'm much more of a, I'm kind of organic, and I'm in the moment. I know organic is a word that people use a lot, but, you know, true self is another one too. And I can kind of look back now at everything that I was leading up to this moment, and it all makes perfect sense to me, you know. I don't like what a lot of my behavior was during that time that I drank and used, but that's literally what I've changed, you know, and everything that comes with it. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a hell of a journey, and it's funny, like, on the back end of this is like, it's not like I'm launching into any kind of tour or anything like that. I'm really just playing on records and stuff like that. And, you know, fortunately been really busy, and, so all of that's good, but it's the same kind of stuff, you know. I mean, I play mostly on country records and, the occasional, thing that is not country.
Right.
You know, today what was really interesting is one of the things that we were doing, I know Kid Rock is a very polarizing figure. When I go in and play on something, we're not talking politics or any of that shit. We're just making music, and the guy is a motherfucking musician, man. And he understands pocket and rhythm, and so we were playing on a few things that are kind of more like what a band would play, but we've also been just jamming sections of stuff that he'll take and use. I don't know, like if he got back into so his earlier stuff, which is much more
sampling,
kind of rap oriented.
Just taking groove and
rapid, yeah,
so looping. And
there was one thing today where I played for about 30 minutes in a tempo, and it was fucking great. Like really, really enjoyable and you know, really cool sounds and way different than the stuff I normally do. Like, this wasn't even a song. This is basically just a tempo and a feel that he, you know, said, hey, I wanted to, he's a great programmer. So he'll have stuff that he has done like on a Lindrum or he's got everything. Got all the vintage stuff and anything new, and he's very prolific, and prolific in the moment too. Tons of ideas, and you know, sparks his creativity, and really impressed, you know, by him. Certainly understands rhythm. Like, I could be playing at a certain tempo, and he's like, "Is that, that's like 117?" I'm like, "Yeah, it is." You know, like, he spent so much time programming. He's just got a great sense for it. So that's been a lot of fun, and been doing that the last couple of days, doing that again tomorrow. And mostly it's just, you know, playing on country records is what I'm doing, and I like it. I also produced a record a couple of years ago on a guitar player now named Tom Bukovac. It's all instrumental. Tom is... he's homeschooling on YouTube, which is a very popular guitar player destination. And he made a record called Plexi Soul, which I produced. And Shannon Forrest actually played all the drums on it.
So that's an example of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The producer guy stepping back and going, all right, I'm going to do one job, right?
Yeah, and Shannon is phenomenal. And he's a dear, dear friend. Love that guy. The band that was, you know, they had played a couple of club gigs, and Shannon was already in the band. And when Tom asked me to be a part of the project, it's like, we just need to take that into the studio, which I think was their general idea anyway. But I mean, had I thought, hey, I'll play on it, I mean, Tom would have been open to that too. But I love Shannon's plan, and in particular, the sort of moment of in time that was happening with all of them together, the guys playing together. It's like, I just need to capture that. Shannon's got an amazing studio at his house, and we cut it all to analog. I think we used Click maybe on two songs, maybe. And the only thing digital on it is... we sent files out to Lenny Castro, and he played on.
Yeah.
Because he and Shannon were out with Toto, you know. And so, man, this is a great record. If you're not familiar with Shannon Plain, or even if you are,
yeah.
It's called Plexi Soul. It's on Bandcamp. And if you're a CD person, I think you can buy them through a place called Guitar House in Tulsa. And we should have vinyl coming out in the fall. What else have I done? I played a little bit on that Trip the Witch record. I just played on one track of that. And that's Tom and Dean DeLeo from Stone Temple Pilots. Yeah. That's a cool record, too. That's... there's Shannon's on there. I'm on there. There's a couple other drummers. It's just escaping me who it is. It'll come to me. But that's a cool thing.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
When you're as a producer yourself, but I want to ask you this: what makes a good producer for you as the drummer?
Oh man, so that's a great question. There's the what I would call a real producer. Are the guys that are becoming more extinct. So I worked quite a bit with a producer named Peter Collins, British producer. And he's like the quintessential old school producer. So what you're talking about, here's what's important. Arrangement, pocket, sounds, vocal, and just doesn't want any bullshit, but it has to be emotive. And that kind of died as Pro Tools and post tracking editing became the thing. Mm-hmm. So these guys that I'm talking about, guys like Peter Collins, Tony Brown, Dan Huff, you get it on the floor. It has to come together on the floor. And when you're the drummer on those dates, you have to have the concept in your mind that this is not going to be edited, even if it is. They don't think in those terms. Like, it has to happen in front of them. They're not going to go through... Now, Dan is much more modern. He'll dive through, 50 playlists of shit to find what he wants. On the floor, when you're working with him, he dictates it as if this is the definitive thing, like you would on analog. Nothing's going to get changed, so you have to deliver a performance. That's my favorite, where I have to compose a part from start to finish, and I play it in that way. And you might go back in and punch a couple sections that you didn't get right, but you're playing it as if this is the performance. I'm not going, oh, hey, four playlists back, there was a better verse and blah, blah, blah. It's like each time you're doing it, you're playing top to bottom exactly how it would be. And that's my favorite. Now, there are all a lot of guys who what I would call the cut-and-paste kind of people, They're younger, but not young. They're usually in their, 35 to 40 are the real cut-and-pasters. Live instruments are sort of secondary, and that's fine. It is what it is, there's not a ton of room for expression in that, because you're typically playing to programming as well. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be like Nat's ass tight. I play that way anyway, even if I know they're probably going to edit it anyway. But it sounds more human the tighter you try to play on the date after they edit it. You follow me? So if you play loose as fuck and then they edit it, it sounds strange. But if you're already trying to play as tight as you can to the click and then they're just nudging you, milliseconds, I feel better personally hearing that back. It's like, well, that was the intent. Right. You know?
Yeah, 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 I got you.
And if you're playing with, like, programming, you know, you're dealing with phasing and shit like that, and so they're going to scooch you because if they have a programmed kick that they like, when it fires in a certain spot on the grid and your live kick, you know, because they're not always right. It's not just about lining them up. Sometimes they can phase cancel each other, but if they're just slightly off, there's a certain throw and a largeness to the sound, you know. And that's really on them to get, you know. But yeah. I will try to play as tight as possible on that. And none of this I mind. I don't mind any of it, but my favorite is the first example.
Like what makes a good producer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's really just knowing which take is the right one. And those guys, because they're listening so intently to the whole song, seem to pick the better takes. Whereas the guys that are more cut and pasters, it's just, did the information occur inside of those four bars so I can cut it?
But are there producers that you've worked with or work with where they don't really play an instrument? They don't really know that. They don't speak that language.
Yeah.
And yet you go...
Yeah, Pierre Collins doesn't.
Oh, okay,
doesn't play.
But yeah,
play chords on a guitar.
I was just gonna say because you name him as one of your favorites.
And he's a vocal. I mean, I think he has a degree in voice.
Okay.
You know,
but so he can hit at least the notes of what he's talking.
Yeah, about. But as a drummer, he's like.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean more like almost like I keep
like Rick Rubin. Yeah, no, I don't really work with anybody like that. Mm-hmm. I don't really work with anybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't. I have a problem with it, you know.
Do you need direction or anything? So
nah.
You got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just talking, you know.
Yeah.
Here's your steak. Oh, you want it medium. Okay. Got it. I mean...
Sometimes they want black and blue. Very rare. That's rare to see that. Not rare as
yeah.
in...
Yeah, yeah.
But like what you mean.
Here's what's crazy is the younger producers listen to old records and go, how the fuck do you get that? They don't know how to get it. Because right. they've never worked with a band on the floor.
Right.
They just hear the older records and go, what the fuck is that? Like, yeah. That's a human being, buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's four human beings playing together.
That's what that is.
That's what that is. There is no plug-in for that. Sorry. And they have plug-ins now of where you can, like, put a little warble and detune on a sample to try to get it more human. Now, the problem with is, the good problem is that these younger guys are seeing through it. Because they do that, and they go, well, why the fuck doesn't it sound like Abbey Road? How come when bass player on my keyboard goes up the neck, I'm not hearing that out-of-tune rub like McCartney's? Because his intonation is out. But see that, we react to the emotion of it, you know? I can't get my programmed drums to speed up a little bit into the chorus like Ringo does. Like, fuck no, you can't. But you can get a human to do that, you know? Yeah. That's what's really cool about what's the younger thing is what is fucking cool.
So does that mean you end up playing with no click?
Can. Yeah, they're not afraid of it. Because they know they can chop it up. They've done so much shit in terms of manipulating samples and everything, they are fearless. You know? Give me the thing I can't get on my computer.
Right. Yeah, 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 yeah.
That's really what we're talking about.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I can't buy... There's no Fruity Loops that are doing that because right. they are... They're compressed to a certain time.
Yeah.
You know, but...
So in a way, that's actually kind of exciting.
Oh, it's really exciting. Yeah. Let me tell you, man. Yeah. For somebody that's been doing this since 1985, you know.
Yeah, because they're juiced. They're jacked. They're like, woo-woo, excited. And...
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things that we cut today, you know, with Kid Rock, are like, fuck the click, man.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Fuck the click. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, yes.
Sometimes you use it. We did do a few things with click, but it just, for certain songs, it's just like, man, let it tug and pull and, you know.
By the way, you
like
just
like those terrible Stones records. They're fucking horrible.
I know. Well, that's always the thing, right? The Brown Sugar speeding up. I believe it's Brown Sugar. I've said that.
Yeah.
You mentioned 85.
Yeah.
I don't know if we talked about it. Larry London, did you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have talked about this before in other podcasts, but like the first week I was in Nashville, I went to TOG Percussion and Larry was there. And I think I bought a Noble and Cooley snare drum from him. I think that's why I was there. If I didn't buy it that day, I went back a couple days later and bought it. But we met each other then, and he asked me what I was doing there. At the time, I was playing drums in this Christian band, White Heart. One of the guys of the band, Billy, was a producer who had hired Larry to play on things. So when I walked in there and Larry said, hey, what do you, you know, oh, you new in town? Yeah, I'm playing with this band, White Heart. He knew who that was. So there was already a little bit of a like, oh, okay, cool. That's that band this producer is in.
Okay.
Who hires me. And we talked a little bit, and he said, and this was like a Monday or something. He's like, well, what are you doing Wednesday? I said, fuck, nothing. He goes, all right, come by the studio and put a set of headphones on. You can. He said, I'm going to show you all the shit that nobody can tell you. You can't. And this, dude, this is 85. I mean, you talk about there's pre-internet. You know, this is, if you wanted information, you had to go to the library, you know. So he invited me along, and I showed up there, and I sat next to him, put a set of headphones on, and I mean, within, you know, an hour, I learned, oh, this is what it is, you know. Stupid stuff that is all, you know, probably second nature to a lot of people now, but even counting off a song, you know, how you do that, how you set the tone, you know. What? Two! You know, you just... You got to get the room to respond. And even wrangling everybody, you know. All right, you fucks, let's go. Come on, let's go. Let's get a take. All of that. And he was, man, what a presence. He's just in charge, you know. And... the impact of him playing, sitting next to him, just was just like, oh shit. And just hearing him light the fucking room up, you know, the velocity. And he played with finesse too and everything, but fucking Freight Train. It's like, oh, this is it, you know? And it was an incredible education, you know, how he tuned his drums, we changing the snare drum and why, all of that within a day. Like, oh, okay. Yeah, you don't just play the same snare on every song. You know, you use different tuning for a ballad and stuff that he did that was open and cracking. He was really into, like, you know, 30s and 40s Black Beauties and stuff like that at the time. And he had all that stuff. Like, he had that shit long before it became Vogue. I mean, I guess Robinson was using that shit too at the time in 85. So it was a thing. But remember, you know, with no internet, you didn't know that that was the thing. You know what I mean? Now, you see four guys post, hey, I just got so-and-so snare drum. You're like, oh, well, that's the snare drum. In 1985, it would take you, like, Back in the High Life, you know, came out in, I don't know, 84, 85 or something. And then whenever John finally did an interview about it is when you discovered, it's like, oh, the snare drum on Finer Things and Back in the High Life, that's a vintage Black Beauty. It's not any one of the reissues. It's like a 40s or something. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. You know, like the hi-hats, what the fuck are those hi-hats? You know, it takes you 8 months to realize that those are new beat hi-hats, you know. Now, it's instant, you know. So the point to all of this is getting to just sit with him and watch him play. It was like, all right, this is the big boy shit right here, you know.
Just one day.
Yeah. And then we continued a relationship. We would run into each other. And years later after that, like around 91 or something like that, I was touring with Amy Grant and we were in rehearsal. and I was triggering a 4-hat for samples because they, you know, was basically I was emulating a programmed record, most of that. I played on the tracks on that record, of the Heart in Motion record, that are on the floor. But like that song, Baby Baby, that's a drum machine, you know. And so they wanted me to be triggering those sounds off the kit. Now, I don't know if you guys know, but in, you know, 90, 91, triggering was like as archaic as it gets, you know. And this is when you were gluing piezo triggers on the inside of your shells of your drums. And it was terrible. It did like no dynamics really, you know. And all the sounds were on a floppy disk. And when you needed like 8 seconds for the samples to load, you know, you didn't just turn the knob and your next set of sounds were in there. You turned it and then the SCSI drive was, sent a signal and the samples were loaded because you were on that patch, you know. Internally, it couldn't hold more than so many samples at a time. There just wasn't enough memory in the thing, you know. And so I was having trouble with it, and I ran into Larry, and he sent his son, Sean, to help me figure some things out, which he did. Because Larry was one of the first guys who was playing D-drum stuff and...
That's right.
...triggering, and he was way fucking ahead of his time. And so his son, Sean, had, you know, would work with him on that stuff, checking it out. Like, Larry is a guy that... I would run into him over at a place called... NCS, Nashville Cartage and Sound. He would book a rehearsal room to integrate a new piece of gear. Like, you know what I mean? He'd like book like 3 hours and have his shit set up and sit there and work on it. You know, He didn't just show up at the studio with a new piece of gear and go, oh, I'm going to figure this out, you know. And I learned that from him too, you know, of, this is a thing. It's important. It's important to get on the date and know what your gear does and know how to use it. That kind of stuff. And just a general, the good kind of... Larry had the really good kind of pride about being a drummer, you know? Like, he was never a dick. But you wouldn't want to fuck with him, you know? Like... He was an imposing character in the best of ways, you know. So I was really lucky.
He was a big guy.
Yeah, he was. And not only just big, but his presence was big, you know. But we should wrap up pretty soon.
I understand, man. I think it's great that you get to share some Larry London, though.
Oh, yeah, no. And man, there's nothing like... just sitting next to him, the impact. His foot was, you know, there aren't words.
Yeah.
There aren't words, man. You say it was like cannon-like or that kind of thing. But he played with some finesse, man. And his...
The doubles?
Oh. It's like, caw. Fucking throw you back.
So it's just one of a kind thing. That's what I'm getting. Yeah. It's like you've seen a lot of guys play with this.
Big note drumming, man.
Yeah.
Big note drumming, but with some swing.
Just curious, is there anyone else even close to what he.
No.
Interesting.
No, I don't think so.
Interesting.
I don't think so.
That much of a stamp. Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're in the. There's certain things that are in the family, right? Like that kind of time.
Yeah.
That kind of time shows up in, you know, you get it. And these are all different types of players. Like, because like Steve Ferrone still has that kind of time, but he's a little more what I would call top kit leaning. So the velocity of the kick drum is not as violent. Although the presence and the perception of time is the same.
Larry was from the kick drum.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And the finesse was on the 2 and the 4?
No, it was between. Between, yeah. Clean fucking hi-hats that always danced. I mean, you've got guys who have notes that are that size, like Mickey Curry, you know, but Mickey swings a lot more than Larry did. Larry was machine-like, but with a little bit of swing, you know. Mickey's wider in the best of ways. Fucking love Mickey's playing. Huge influence on
Mickey fucking Curry,
and
man.
He is fantastic human being too. You know, Robinson has the same kind of presence. He's in between London and Ferrone would be Robinson. That's how where I would put him.
Interesting.
You know, if you're looking that on that like of a scale. That's in that those guys are all in that family, you know. I'm trying to think who else I would.
Just a deep pocket. You're putting him in with that category. Deep pocket.
Yeah, it's deep pocket drumming, you know. And like I said, Larry would be the furthest into the deepest, you know. Then you'd have and I'm excluding Jeff because he was his own thing.
Yeah, okay.
He was his own thing.
Sure.
That's a whole other thing, which is fucking brilliant and just as commanding. I mean, man, I could talk about Jeff forever, you know. Let's just talk about composition. Let's talk about what you play and why. And what does it mean? And never played anything throwaway, you know. Yeah, I gotta go, man.
Man, sorry. Chris McHugh, thank you so much, man. Part 2.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
We'll do it again. And,
Yeah.
You know, we cover some good ground.
Let's not wait 10 years.
Yeah, you got it.
Thank you, brother.
Sounds good. Thank you, Ben.